It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 901 for the 27th of September, 2024. This week, the National Institutes of Health would like to know more about you. Share some information with the All of Us Project, and you'll help researchers understand more about disease treatment, control, and prevention. In short circuits, with the internet drowning in the proliferation of scams and fraud, staying safe involves treating any message from any source with more than a bit of skepticism. And when the plastic battery cover on my Bose TV speaker remote control broke, I contacted Bose to see if they sold replacements. What should have been a 5-minute chat went on for 40 minutes, required a 20-minute follow-up chat, and the problem involving a 5-cent part still hasn't been resolved. All of Us is a project of the National Institutes of Health, and depending on your view of bureaucratic federal health agencies, you'll be somewhere on the spectrum of wanting to sign up immediately, learn a little more about it, or avoid it, pardon the dumb joke, like the plague. I said bureaucratic, knowing that some people will view that word as an epithet, so let me explain that that is not my intent. A bureaucracy is simply a body of non-elected government officials or an administrative policy-making group that is intended to ensure certain guidelines are followed. The National Institutes of Health is the primary biomedical and public health research agency in the United States. It dates back to the late 1880s. The NIH conducts its own scientific research and provides major biomedical research funding for other organizations. If you'd like to learn more about the NIH, check Wikipedia. There's a link to the entry on the TechBiter Worldwide website. All of Us has as its objective the development of a large and diverse health database that is being built from information shared by U.S. citizens. All of Us, as the name implies. This information can be used to find better ways to treat or prevent illness. More information gives scientists better insights into common and not-so-common illnesses. If that's enough to interest you in joining All of Us, great! You can sign up at the link I provide on the TechBiter Worldwide website. If you need more information, stick with me for a bit. I'll explain why I signed up several years ago, what's involved, and why you might want to be part of the group. It starts with a clear description of what All of Us is all about. Too often, it says, healthcare is one size fits all. But imagine a future where prevention, treatment, and care are tailored for you. That future starts with research that includes all of us. That's the statement you'll find on the All of Us website. Nearly everyone living in the United States is eligible to join, with the exception of people in prison, adults who are unable to consent on their own, and children. The project started in 2015. It aims to collect genetic and health data from 1 million volunteers. Information and materials are available in English and Spanish. Participants receive occasional newsletters and messages that describe a need for information about a specific health condition or that offer online exercises or tests that you might find interesting or even helpful. In some cases, exercises are repeated occasionally so you can observe your own performance changes over time. Research materials collected by All of Us have been used to address the COVID-19 pandemic. Electronic health records, when participants agree to share them with the project, can also be used to detect patterns associated with COVID and other infectious diseases. Having a computer, a tablet, or a smartphone makes participation easier, but it's not required. No health insurance is required, and All of Us does not provide any kind of medical treatment. Recently, All of Us has started requesting access to the participants' electronic health records. This is optional. All of Us asks participants to answer several health surveys. Answers provided are not associated with the participant's identity and are used simply to build the database. Approved researchers can access the database to conduct their studies. There is one warning that the project makes absolutely clear, and I quote here, "The main risk of sharing your EHRs is to your privacy. It is a low risk, but it is not zero." So if that concerns you, and really it should, you want to check out the explanation on the All of Us website. I have a link to that on the TechBiter Worldwide website, too. If you decide to share your EHR data, the site will walk you through the reasons your information will be beneficial to the program, what information is collected, what happens, and who will have access to it. Before you can give permission to share your electronic health records, you also have to answer several questions correctly to confirm that you understand the explanation. Part of my medical record from nearly 2 years ago shows the emergency surgical procedure on my spine. You'll see that on the TechBiter Worldwide website. Participation in this part of the project won't be for you if you're concerned about allowing others to see your health information. Researchers, however, don't see your name or other identification information, only your demographics and the condition being treated. In some cases, All of Us asks participants for measurement of physical characteristics, such as height, weight, blood pressure, and such. Blood and urine samples are sometimes requested. These are optional, and there's no cost involved. The objective is to gain information about the widest possible variety of people, including those who are often underrepresented in research. So, although it's doubtful any research using my data will ever be of any benefit to me, it is possible that research based on my data will help others. If you'd like to sign up or just learn more, start at the All of Us website. You'll find a link on the TechBiter Worldwide website, www.techbiter.com. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In Short Circuits, an email from Bitdefender warns about scammers who are posing as toll services via mobile messages. There are no toll roads where I live, but there is the Ohio Turnpike in the northern part of the state. So this turns out to be just another example of how clever scammers can be. Here's the example that Bitdefender cited. California Toll Services has noted your vehicle has an unpaid invoice. To avoid additional fees amounting to $59.89, please settle the outstanding balance of $5.79. Then the message provides a very helpful link. If the recipient has a California EasyPay ID, it would be easy to think that it's only $6 and I'll be charged 10 times that if I don't take care of it, so I better take care of it right away. No, the scammers aren't out to make a fortune on $6 payments. Follow the link, fill in the information, and the scammers will at least have enough information to use your credit card fraudulently. But the site will probably also tell the mark that they have to prove their identity for their own protection, of course. And then the scammer will have enough information for identity theft. This toll road scam won't be effective in large areas of the United States where toll roads don't exist. But there are lots of other scams that have very broad appeal. One common scam that fools far too many people involves thieves who impersonate government agencies, financial institutions, or businesses claiming that you need to make urgent payments with a gift card, or you'll face certain legal action. The caller may claim to be from the sheriff or a taxing agency. Maybe your tax payment is late, or you'll be arrested for missing jury duty unless you immediately pay a fine. Immediately! Well, that's not the way it works. Nothing in the legal system is ever instant, and no agency will ever demand that you pay with a gift card. But these creeps create a false sense of urgency, pressure you into buying expensive gift cards, and then give them the numbers from the back of the card. So before acting, stop and think. Be a skeptic. Is the originating phone number in your area code? Is it even in the United States? Before clicking the URL, go to the Toll Collecting Authority's website. If you have a token, you'll also have an account with the Toll Collecting Organization. Sign in and see if you really do have a balance due. The same is true for any kind of message. I recently saw a message that claimed in the subject line there had been suspicious activity on a bank account. It cited a bank where I do have an account, but I didn't even have to open the message to identify it as a scam because the from address indicated that it originated in India. Well, the bank is not in India. It's trivial to spoof the displayed address shown for the sender, but most scammers don't even bother. But if the message passes the first test, you still need to be skeptical, and there are many indicators to look for. The sender's email address may look similar to a legitimate address, but not exactly the one that belongs to the organization being impersonated. It's even possible to register domain names that contain Greek or Russian characters that resemble Latin characters. These are impossible to detect visually, and it's why you should avoid clicking links in messages. For example, you'll see two URLs on the TechBiter Worldwide website. One is real, one is fake. Can you tell the difference? Although they look identical on the screen, one contains the Russian characters se and o in place of the Latin characters c and o. It's best to simply avoid clicking any URL in any message. But if you do have to click it, start at least by hovering the mouse over the link. If the text says Microsoft.com, but the displayed destination you see with the mouse hovering is scammer.scambot.cm/fraud/really-long-name.exe, don't click it. And no, there is no scammer who would make the fraud so obvious. And again, when you're hovering the mouse, you see the characters that the scammer wants you to see. So if the scammer is using Russian characters or Greek characters, you'll never know. Examine the message for how you are addressed. There's probably not a financial institution anywhere that will refer to you as dear customer. And most businesses do the same. They will address you by your name, and not with a generic greeting or your email. Consider any email that attempts to engender a sense of urgency or fear, urging you to act quickly, to be highly suspect. And it's almost certainly a scam if they require you to prove your authenticity by providing an account number, password, or social security number. The bank or store will already have that information if they need it. One of the key giveaways is the presence of grammatical errors, awkward phrasing, and spelling mistakes. Scammers are getting better, but many do not speak corporate English. A real message from a real company will have been examined by lawyers, editors, and public relations professionals, so it won't sound like something written by Uncle Ed who flunked out of eighth grade. Look for inconsistencies in logos, colors, or overall design that may not match the official branding of the organization. This is much less common than in the past, and design failures like that are marks of true amateur scammers. Emails promising large sums of money, prizes, or gifts are usually fraudulent. A Nigerian prince doesn't want to give you $1 million. A dying widow won't send you the money her corrupt husband embezzled. You haven't won the Irish or any other lottery, especially if you didn't buy a ticket. When I picked up the remote control for my Bose TV speaker to increase the volume, nothing happened. Maybe the battery needed to be replaced, I figured, so I flipped the remote over, and I noticed that the battery was missing. Somehow, the round battery cover had apparently rotated to the unlocked position and fallen off. The battery and the cover were lying in the plastic tray where I keep the remotes. I put the battery back in, placed the round cover on it, rotated it into the locked position, and the round cover and the battery promptly fell onto the desk. Thinking that I had not locked the cover properly, I tried again. The result was the same. Then I noticed that one of the locking tabs from the round cover was missing. It was in the tray with the other remotes. The battery's one of those long-lasting round mercury batteries that hadn't been replaced in years, perhaps never, so I hadn't broken the tab by replacing the battery. It had just broken all by itself while lying in the tray with the other remotes. Bose probably sells replacement battery covers for $1 or $2, I thought. This is a 10-cent part, so it probably costs $5, and the shipping will be another $5. So paying $10 for a 10-cent part will probably fix it. The Bose website offered options for setup and maintenance, troubleshooting, downloading a manual, or finding an accessory. No options for replacement parts. Surely Bose will have an online support option where I can order the replacement part, I thought. After opening a chat session, I found that I was talking with a chatbot that couldn't deal with replacement parts, but it did connect me to a real person, Rachel, in less than 10 minutes. As chatbots go, that was pretty good. 15 minutes later, Rachel found that replacement battery covers were not stocked. After another 14 minutes, Rachel had spoken with her supervisor and found that Bose would be happy to send a replacement remote control for free. That seemed like a good solution. Stupidly expensive for Bose, but it would work. Except that it wouldn't. Remotes weren't in stock. They should be available in 2 weeks, and Rachel gave me an incident number so I could open another chat session 2 weeks later and order the part then. That's right, there was no way for Rachel to enter the order so that the replacement would be shipped when the remotes were back in stock. It took another 10 minutes, and then Rachel was able to give me the incident number to use 2 weeks in the future. So, 45 minutes yielded the promise of a possible solution. In the meantime, I have a workaround that involves the careful application of surgical tape. When it was time to put the finishing touches on this report, the event had morphed into the never-ending story. 16 days later, Bose still didn't have the remote in stock, and I was instructed to try again in 2 weeks. At least this session with Bose support took only 20 minutes to produce no useful outcome. One would expect a company to have a method in place to allow ordering an out-of-stock item that would then be shipped when it was once again available. Bose apparently hasn't mastered that technology. So the next time I need an audio device, I'll probably select a manufacturer other than Bose. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.